On the program today, GDP, Brexit, TSLA, that's a ticker symbol. Also, some other abbreviations and initialisms from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 30th of January today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A brief discourse as we begin about two things. Number one, the general health of this economy. And number two, the global context within which this economy does its thing. From the Commerce Department this morning came our first peek at economic growth for the fourth quarter of last year, and with it, the early estimate of growth for all of 2019. September through New Year's, the American economy grew at an annualized rate of 2.1%. For the full year, 2.3%, well below, it ought to be noted, what President Trump and his advisors have been promising with their policy prescriptions. Also, a slowdown from 2018 to boot. Of particular interest to us today, the line item in this report covering business investment, what companies are spending on equipment and computers and office supplies and the like. It has been falling for three straight quarters now. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with what we ought to take from that.
For 9 months now, American businesses have been spending less and less money on things they might need in the future.
Everything that you have in your office, everything that you have in a production factory, that is business investment.
And that is Torsten Slok, chief economist at Deutsche Bank.
As the trade war came along, we began to see business spending begin to slow down. And unfortunately, it's been on a steady slowdown for essentially the last 18 months or so.
Business investment accounts for about 13% of GDP, more than $2.8 trillion. So if businesses are kind of backing away slowly from investing in the future, what does that mean for the future?
The last time we saw business investment decline for three quarters or more was heading into the 2008-2009 recession.
Nicholas Bloom is professor of economics at Stanford. We are not, rest assured, Bloom says, about to have another big recession. The decline in business investment now is tiny compared to what it was back then.
It's worrying, although not surprising.
For now, shrinking business investment means our economy is growing more slowly, which we've known. GDP growth in the fourth quarter of 2019 was 2.1%. It was 2.9% overall back in 2018. Richard DeKayser is chief corporate economist with Wells Fargo & Company.
Over the long run, if we as a society do not invest in upgrading and modernizing and expanding our capital stock with newer and better machinery and structures, equipment, we'll be less productive.
And economists say they do not expect a rebound in business investment around the corner. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
So that's us. But as I mentioned above, there is the small matter of the rest of the global economy. We also learned this morning that the Mexican economy actually contracted last year. Not a lot, a tenth of a percent for all of 2019. But it is the worst showing for the Mexican economy in a decade. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
The economic news on Mexican cable network Milenio today wasn't good. While a lot of economies hit speed bumps in 2019, Mexico hit a roadblock, says Council on Foreign Relations Latin America analyst Shannon O'Neill.
Mexico has definitely been affected by the softness in U.S. manufacturing, and particularly in the automobile industry, in aerospace.
That's because parts and finished goods go back and forth across the border again and again before being shipped to their final destination. And Monica DeBole at the Peterson Institute says this complex supply chain often involves another country, China.
Mexico appears to have been the hardest hit economy on a macro level by the U.S.-China trade war. A lot of the supply chains between the U.S. and China run through Mexico.
As well as Mexico's manufacturing sector, construction and consumption have also been weak. Economist Ray Perryman chalks that up to uncertainty. He says business owners and international investors have been spooked by Mexico's new president canceling big infrastructure projects. And the border's been volatile.
In 2019, there was discussion about diverting the resources that are used to clear cargo back and forth in order to deal with the refugee situation. There has been some slowdown in the retail traffic both sides of the border.
Other problems, meanwhile, continue to plague the country, says Monica DeBole.
It's a slow-growing economy, and one of the reasons is the drag posed by the security, narco-trafficking, corruption issues.
She says even in the best of times, the Mexican economy hasn't grown more than about 2.5%. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, down for most of the session, then traders cheered up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Grand Place, the main square in Brussels, Belgium, the headquarters of the European Union, was lit up in the colors of the Union Jack tonight, the British flag, of course, in a farewell to the United Kingdom, which, as of tomorrow, is going to be out of the EU. Kinda. Because the past 3.5 years since the Brexit vote have been merely, it turns out, prologue. Amanda Sloat is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, whence she has been keeping an eye on Brexit. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let us, as Boris Johnson might say, look not to the past, but to the future after Brexit. What changes tomorrow? Anything?
So the main change that happens tomorrow after 11 p.m. London time and midnight Brussels time is that UK officials no longer have access to EU decision making. British members of the European Parliament packed up their offices this week, and British ministers will no longer participate in EU decision making institutions. That said, for citizens and businesses, everything will largely remain the same during this transition period.
And this is the period in which, well, there's going to be a whole bunch of things happening, but one big thing of which will be the negotiation of the future relationship of the UK to the European Union, yes?
Absolutely. That is going to be the main task of the British government and the EU over the next 11 months. The Brexit deal only finalizes the divorce. We now need to sort out what the future relationship is going to look like. And while most of the focus has been on the economic side of that, they also are going to have to work out a large number of security, judicial, and law enforcement type issues.
Fair to say that for as agonizing as the period has been since the Brexit referendum in 2016, what we're looking at now over the next 11 months is the really hard part?
Absolutely. Yeah. Despite Boris Johnson campaigning on a slogan of getting Brexit done, we really are only seeing the end of the beginning. The negotiations coming up are going to be very contentious and, as things currently stand, a very tight timetable in which to get things done.
About that timetable, Ursula von der Leyen, the new head of the European Union, has said we're basically not going to be able to get it done in a year, right?
It's not even a year. At its most, it will be 11 months. Both the UK and the EU need to put out their negotiating stances. That's not expected to happen until the end of February, which means these trade talks won't start until the beginning of March. And depending on the type of agreement that they reach, it's possible that it would need to be ratified by all 27 of the EU member states. And in some cases, that includes their subnational parliaments. But certainly anything comprehensive is very unlikely to be negotiated and ratified within this time frame.
I'm sorry to chuckle, but it does seem like every time we turn around, this entire escapade just gets harder and harder and harder.
Well, it never was going to be easy, contrary to what some of the Brexiteer campaigners may have thought. And when you are looking at very weedy issues of economics, of trade, of regulations and security, it is going to be quite complicated to try and assemble that in a way that is going to satisfy the EU's desire to protect their single market and give the British government the degree of sovereignty that they are hoping to achieve through Brexit.
Not only is the UK government working on a deal with the EU, it's working hard on a deal with the United States. President Trump has talked about it a lot. It's not that also will not be easy.
No, that's not going to be easy either. And to make matters more complicated, the British government had campaigned on the basis of negotiating with the U.S. and the EU at the same time. The Trump administration wants to have another quick win in an election year, and the Johnson government is hoping to demonstrate quickly to its public that Brexit has benefits. But given that you are likely to have differences on things like food standards, the environment, and pharmaceutical pricing, these are not likely to be easy negotiations either.
Not only that, but also there's the Huawei decision from the other day, also Iran sanctions. The two are not on the same side. I mean, there are political military things that come into effect here, too.
Absolutely. And the UK is going to face broader decisions on how it wants to align itself with the European Union or with the United States. And this Huawei decision also looks likely to move the UK closer to the EU's position on that, which has had some Trump administration officials questioning what this means in terms of intelligence sharing with the UK, and some hawkish Republicans in Congress questioning how this will affect their ratification of a possible trade deal with the UK.
Amanda Sloat, she's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Amanda, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We mentioned the other day, I think, the new Congressional Budget Office report on the federal deficit, annual red ink of $1.3 trillion, annual red ink in that amount, till at least the end of the decade, which means the laws of finance tell us that we're going to have to borrow money, a lot of money. The way the government borrows is by selling bonds. We talk about that a lot on the program, usually the 10-year treasury, sometimes the 30-year crops up, but $1.3 trillion a year means we are going to need more bonds, which is why the Treasury Department announced last week it's going to start selling 20-year notes as well. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on the bond beat today.
The new bonds probably won't have ordinary investors lining up to buy them. But 20-year bonds will appeal to investors who manage ordinary people's money, like their retirement funds, says Chuck Tomes at Manulife Investment Management.
You're going to see pension plans, insurance companies that would be natural buyers of these securities.
Take a pension fund, for instance. Jim Vogel at FHN Financial says pension funds are hungry for long-term bonds that mature when the retiree needs the money. And in a lot of cases, a 20-year bond fits right in.
So in particular, as you think about putting together a pension fund for retirees, you're going to have investment horizons that are in 15 to 30 years in maturity.
The Treasury used to offer 20-year bonds, but stopped in the 80s. Vogel says back then, 30-year bonds were just more popular, partly because they paid a lot more in interest. Now investors will have to figure out how to work the new bonds into their portfolios.
The new bond needs to become a habit, and it takes a while for that to occur.
But for the government, part of the appeal of a 20-year bond is that it's really not all that different from a 10-year or a 30-year bond.
I would think that the learning period here would be shorter than if they were to introduce an ultra-long bond.
That's Seth Carpenter, chief U.S. economist at UBS and a former Treasury official. The Treasury had been considering 50-year bonds, even 100-year bonds. But Carpenter says those would have been uncharted territory.
With a 50-year and especially a 100-year bond, there's not a lot of data. There's no way to know for sure where those bonds would price.
That matters because that lack of data could have pushed the government to pay more in interest on those ultra-long-term bonds to make up for that uncertainty.
Whereas with a 20-year, there already exists data that have that kind of remaining maturity. It's in between the 10-year and the 30-year. That would give you some idea.
He says that data will help the government lower the interest on those 20-year bonds. Interest American taxpayers ultimately pay. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I stocked up while the deals were on, and I think I'm good for a few months.
Someone was thinking ahead, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 124 points today, 0.4%, 28,859. The NASDAQ found 23 points, 0.2%, 92.98. The S&P 500 advanced 10 points, 0.3%, 32.83 there. Amazon released its latest numbers after the bell, beat estimates for fourth quarter revenue. The company said its efforts to speed deliveries helped attract more shoppers during the holiday season. Amazon moving higher in after-hours trading. And when I say higher, I mean like up 11%, $2,100 a share. UPS tumbled 6.7%. The shipper came up short of revenue expectations for the quarter. Facebook down 6.1% a day after reporting earnings last night. They reported a 51% rise in expenses for the year compared to a year ago. It also said those new expenses came from the effort to revamp how it handles privacy and security. Microsoft up 2.8%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's been quite a stretch for Tesla the past couple of months. The electric car maker reported earnings yesterday blew past expectations. Shares continued the ride they've been on since before Christmas, putting a market valuation of more than $100 billion on a company that last year sold a little bit more than 350,000 cars. General Motors, just for some context, sold almost 3 million cars last year. But never mind that. This has been a pile of good news for Elon Musk and his fans and a whole mess of bad news for the not small group of people selling Tesla stock short. Dana Hull wrote about him for Bloomberg. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Give me the 30-second this is short selling thing, would you?
Sure. Well, there are traders who believe that companies are overvalued and they bet against the company. And when the company loses money, they win. And what's fascinating about Tesla is that it is the most shorted stock right now, ever. Yeah. And even though shorts have lost, I think it's about $5.6 billion in 2020, they are still going at it. And they are, you know, sort of doubling down.
The shorting thing with Tesla is really interesting for two reasons. One is the fanatical nature, and I say that not pejoratively, but these people are really obsessed with Tesla and Elon Musk and shorting it, but also how obsessed Musk is with the shorts.
Exactly. It's been like a long-running war for several years now, and the obsession goes both ways. The short sellers who are shorting the stock, I mean, they do an incredible amount of research, not just digging through financials and filings and lawsuits and customer complaints, but like on-the-ground research at the factory, and they kind of share it all on Twitter. And then at the same time, Musk is sort of obsessed with them. He tracks what they're doing very closely.
And they're not always really nice to each other. But let me ask you this. Are shorts providing a service to the wider investing public and the rest of us for finding out what's going on with this admittedly important company in this economy?
Well, I think that depends on who you ask. I mean, advocates would say that they have kind of democratized the due diligence process, and they are sharing their research openly, largely on social media, for anyone else to pick up on. And they have really done a lot of diligence where they might say that some investors have not. Detractors would say that they are just, you know, unrelentingly negative, can't see the forest for the trees, you know, don't understand that the company has done a lot of good and that it's just like a toxic environment.
What's amazing to me is that they are hanging in there even after the last, like, what, 6 weeks in this stock where they're just getting killed, the shorts are.
Right. And that's what makes this such a sort of fascinating story, is like the shorts will always live for another day. I mean, there's always something. You look at the earnings report yesterday, you know, everyone is digging into what's happening with the accounts receivable and why didn't they give guidance for CapEx. I mean, there's always something that they are going to scrutinize to a level that I think is sort of unheard of for other publicly traded companies.
And it's interesting because so far anyway, the shorts have been wrong.
They have not always been right, but they have been right about some things. I mean, they often sort of sense trends long before. I mean, the great example that I'll give is J.B. Straubel, who was the CTO and a co-founder of the company, frankly, started selling off some of his shares. And people within Tesla Q, which is what they're known, called it. They were like, he's leaving. And then sure enough, you know, he announced that he was moving on, not that long ago. So, I mean, they are righteous. They don't always get it right, but they are not always wrong.
Just to recap here, these people, the shorts, are losing real money, $5-something billion, as you said. Is their ability to keep doing this finite? I mean, you can only lose so much, yeah?
I mean, you would think so. And when we say short sellers, I mean, this is everything from, you know, large hedge funds to small retail investors. The way that people do their individual trades is sort of a mystery to me. But the short interest is still very high. And at what point do people throw in the towel?
Dana Hull covers Tesla and SpaceX and, as she says, all things Elon for Bloomberg News. Dana, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Anytime.
I myself am a coffee guy, but for the many millions of tea drinkers out there, y'all better step it up. The world's biggest tea seller announced today it's thinking about getting out of the game. Unilever, owner of Lipton for one, PG Tips for another, maybe you've heard of it. It says it's just not selling as much black tea, Earl Grey, English breakfast, as it used to. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino, Beverage Preferences Unknown, has the story.
Back in the day, Lipton and tea were almost synonymous, as seen on this 1950s TV commercial.
Lipton. More people drink it than all other teas combined.
Lipton tea hangs in my brain.
That's Iowa historian Maureen Ogle. When she was a kid and got sick, her mom would bring her two things, hot buttered Wonder Bread and a cup of Lipton.
Even today, if I smell a cup of Lipton tea, I completely connect it with being comforted. It's very Proustian for me.
Yeah, okay. But those warm memories aren't enough to get her to drink Lipton today, or eat Wonder Bread for that matter. Like many Americans, her tastes have gotten a little more sophisticated.
Today, consumers are looking for their foods and beverages to do more than just provide taste and sustenance.
Darren Seifer is a food industry analyst with NPD Group. He says people want products that seem unique or healthy. For tea, that means green or white or single-origin herbal infusions. Americus Reed is a marketing professor at the Wharton School of Business.
Consumers are connecting with these smaller niche, disruptive, innovative sorts of brands as part of an experience where they can almost immerse themselves into that story.
And basic black tea like Lipton? Not really inspiring. Tea still is one of the most consumed drinks in the world, but for Unilever, it's about growth, and there's not enough of that brewing. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We talked about the Fed a little bit yesterday. Nothing too terribly striking from Chair Jay Powell's press conference. Same, I think, is how I described it. That said, and as Chair Powell would undoubtedly agree, there is nothing like data to help figure out what's going on with the nitty-gritty, how consumers are feeling, how much they're paying, what they are thinking about. So we got on the phone, as we do from time to time, and got us some data.
This is Ellen Murphy calling from Mission Hills, Kansas. Chicken breast, boneless, skinless chicken breast is usually on sale in the middle of the week. So, you know, with the Super Bowl coming up, we're Kansas City's in the Super Bowl. I'm making a huge pot of chili, chicken chili, and I bought that and put it in the freezer already. So it's not an expensive thing to make anyway, but, you know, when you make enough for everybody, try to get the chicken and stuff when it's marked down a couple of bucks, so... Go Chiefs!
Hey Marketplace, this is Michael Devitt in Boise, Idaho. I've noticed a substantial increase in grocery prices over the past few weeks, like really substantial increase in prices. And I was talking to a gentleman today who is an executive with a local grocery chain, and he was telling me that this is likely due to the fact that they are having to pass on increased labor costs to the consumers.
Hi, this is Sudipto Chatterjee from the San Francisco Bay Area. So during the holidays, Costco had these amazing deals on all kinds of alcohol. I grabbed some collections of Scotch whiskeys and Irish creams. But dry January is about to end, so I went back to Costco and now the deals on alcohol are gone. However, I stocked up while the deals were on and I think I'm good for a few months.
Hi Marketplace, this is Chelsea Lepley from Des Moines, Iowa. I have not noticed any changes in the prices of things I buy, but I can confidently predict at least one pending price change here in Des Moines, though. I'm one of the thousands of volunteers leading precinct caucuses this Monday, and I am certain that starting Tuesday, hotel rates will get a lot cheaper in the Hawkeye State as journalists and campaign staff shift their focus to the Granite State's primary elections.
New Hampshire, of course, being the Granite State where the primary is February 11th. That's a week from Tuesday. Chelsea Lepley in Des Moines there at the end. Starting off was Ellen Murphy in Mission Hills, Kansas. Then Michael Devitt in Boise and Sudipta Chatterjee. He's in San Francisco. final note on the way out today, by way of your texting bemusements, the group that's in charge of emojis, and first of all, there is actually a group that's in charge of emojis. Anyway, it's called the Unicode Consortium, and it announced the first batch of new emojis for the year. Among them, an olive, a dodo, a tamale, a mousetrap, and a plunger, some gender-inclusive options as well, including both men and women in tuxes and wedding dresses, and a transgender flag, should all be online by midsummer-ish. And that's it. The Dow Industrial is up 124 points today, 0.4%. NASDAQ, 23 points to the good, 0.2%. The S&P 500 advanced 10 points, 0.3% there. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.